Welcome to Ingenious, a podcast brought to you by Engineers Without Borders Bristol and recorded at the Burst Radio Studios. At Ingenious, we explore the future by talking with the pioneering engineers of today. In this episode, I spoke with Ian Tansley, the founder and CTO of SureChill, a company which aims to change the way the world keeps things cool. Ian has spent his career building sustainable technologies for the developing world and had a lot to say about the process of innovation and convincing others about the merits of big ideas. As always, I started by asking Ian to introduce himself and describe how he got where he is today.
I'm Ian Tansley. I'm an engineering designer, and my particular interest is in applications of engineering in developing countries. So from a very early age, from school, I was given the task of building some ovens that were similar to those that were being built in Africa at the time. And that really sparked something in me, really sparked an interest in me in how can we engineer things that aren't necessarily high tech, that aren't necessarily the cutting edge of technology, but are essential to a better life for people in developing countries.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously the technology at the company you're currently involved with is like that. Do you have any kind of past examples of some previous projects you've worked on as well, very briefly?
Yeah, so I have worked all around the world, mostly in Africa and India, on technologies that are used with renewable energy. So there was a particular project in Nepal that I worked on for a few years, which was to develop a heat storage cooker. And that took energy from hydroelectric plants, a small hydroelectric plant in villages in the Himalayas, where they have just a few hundred watts of connection, so one single light bulb's worth of energy to each individual household. And there's a big problem with deforestation, so they wanted to cut down on the amount of wood that was being burned. And so one way to do that would be to use the electricity that was supplied to the households. Mm-hmm. And we had to find a way to build that energy up through the day in order to provide enough energy for cooking. So that was a four-year project, and we developed something that could be manufactured for, I think it was less than $50 for a household to do all their cooking.
Wow, brilliant. Yeah, so you can kind of see the trajectory that you were taking that led you to SureChill in a way. It's a similar technology. So yeah, just describe briefly what that's all about.
The SureChill technology is a platform technology, we call it, for cooling. So what it enables you to do is to store up energy so if you have intermittent grid power, then you can store up energy and you can use it to cool something when the power is not available. Now, the critical thing there is not that you can store up energy, because you could just make some ice cubes and put them in a fridge and that will keep the fridge cool. But temperature control is very important. Yeah. With a lot of applications, it's about that precise temperature control. Mm-hmm. So you've got to do two things at once. You've got to store energy as efficiently as you can and as cheaply as you can. But also you've got to release that energy in a form which gives you accurate temperature control. Yeah. And that's the really difficult bit to it, is doing the accurate temperature control. So the technology is very simple, and you can do this yourself in your own home. Take yourself a glass of water and half fill it with water from the tap, and then fill the rest of the glass with ice cubes. Mm-hmm. Now wait for about 2 minutes and measure the temperature at the bottom of the glass.
Yeah.
What you'll find is the temperature at the bottom of the glass, the water at the bottom of the glass, is at 4 degrees centigrade.
Right.
And there's a very good reason for that, because water's heaviest at 4 degrees.
Okay.
So unlike most other things that get heavier or lighter if you heat them up or cool them down, water's bizarre in that it's heaviest at 4 degrees, it's lighter if you warm it up, but it's actually lighter if you cool it down as well. So ice will float, even though hot water will also rise.
Right.
Okay, so we use this principle. So you've got this glass of water, there's ice on the top, there's water below it, mm-hmm. and that all of that water underneath the ice is at 4 degrees centigrade. Mm-hmm. So we can now use that 4 degrees centigrade as the perfect place to store vaccines, blood, food, anything that wants storing at conventional refrigeration temperatures, which are typically between 2 and 8 degrees centigrade.
Yeah.
So we're sitting at 4 degrees centigrade, which is just the right side of the average of those two temperatures.
Yeah.
And we can do that with no power. So as long as there's ice in the system, then the water will always be at 4 degrees centigrade.
Yeah. So it's not giving you free energy as such. I guess it's the things that are warming and becoming equilibrium from the environment are just kind of not to the bit where you're actually storing the product. Is that right? So that the ice is maybe still melting or there's still warming going on, but this area is kind of kept isolated from that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the area that we're cooling is surrounded by the water that's underneath the ice.
Yeah.
So long as there's ice there, then the warm water that's created by the heat entering the system, that rises, meets the ice, and then is cooled, and so you get 4 degrees underneath it.
Yeah.
So, but none of that ice can ever go downwards because water's more buoyant when it's colder.
Yeah.
So you can never freeze in that, which is very important for vaccines.
Yes.
But you can also never go too high in temperature either.
Yeah.
So you've got this perfect kind of system, which is automatic. It's working really hard. It responds to changes in temperature, responds really, really quickly to changes. So that bigger the temperature change, the bigger the amount of energy that gets moved.
Yeah, fantastic. So there's something very different about this technology, I guess, from traditional refrigeration. What are kind of the big drawbacks of traditional refrigeration for the kinds of applications that you're looking at?
Well, where we're looking at using technology, you've got very intermittent grid power. So a typical pattern might be 4 or 5 hours of electricity in a day, and then no electricity at all for 2 or 3 days. And so you might get a small cycle going where you've got a few days where you've got electricity and then none for a few more days. So it's very intermittent. It's very difficult to predict. So you need to have a long holdover time in between those power supplies. And so during that time, you also need to maintain temperature. Now, at the same time, the ambient temperature is also generally very high, and it can change quite rapidly. So it can go from quite high to quite low. Mm. So you've got all of these things going on all at once. And so you need something which is not only able to store the energy and do the temperature control, but also do that in that dynamic way as well. So responding to the loads that are the heat loads that are being put inside. So if you put something hot inside, you want it to cool it down. But also if the ambient temperature goes up or down, you don't really want the storage temperature to change.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a lot of people will have experienced a traditional fridge. If that loses power, your food goes off pretty quickly.
So a conventional fridge would go out of temperature within about 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So a conventional fridge, what it's doing all the time, it's allowing its temperature to rise and then it's catching that, putting some cooling into the refrigerator, pulling the temperature back down again until it reached another level and then letting it warm up and going down. So there's this kind of sawtooth kind of temperature profile inside a conventional refrigerator.
Right.
So when you talk about a conventional refrigerator, everyone thinks that the temperature remains the same. Mm. Actually, it's going up and down all the time in response to the thermostat inside.
Yeah.
So our fridge doesn't do that. Our fridge keeps the temperature completely constant all the time and does that with no power and no power input.
So you briefly mentioned vaccines there as a potential application. I can see how that's really great. What else can this be used for? And did you imagine this when you first developed the technology? What did you imagine?
I think my experience is traveling around in Africa and India and places in hot countries and seeing the problems with power supply more generally. So I know that people can't use a refrigerator with the current system. They can't take a current refrigerator from the UK setting, plug it into a power supply in Africa, and it's just going to work. There's something fundamentally that doesn't happen because it will go out of temperature in a few minutes if you take the power off. So there was always that in my mind. So there's always this thing of, yes, we've got this problem with... It was particularly a problem with solar refrigerators, actually, because solar refrigerators, they require a battery. Conventionally, they take a battery. So you charge up a battery from a solar panel and you use the power from the battery to run the fridge. But the batteries are really expensive and unreliable and they'll wear out very, very quickly. Yeah. Within the space of a year or two, you'll need to replace the battery in the system. So that's not a good solution. It wasn't a good solution for the vaccine market. But also it's not a good solution for a domestic market or any other commercial market. So there was a fundamental need to change that. So in the solar world, we needed to get rid of the battery. But also at the same time, it was clear that actually the same problem exists in these other sectors as well.
Yeah, which I guess is a common theme with technology. You think there's a problem in one area, then the more you learn, the more you realise that same problem is experienced by everyone in different ways.
And so there are some fantastic opportunities. If you think of the number of people in the world who've got unreliable power or no power,
Huge.
You know, a billion people, more than a billion people in the world that could benefit from this kind of technology. So there's all of this potential benefit, both in terms of, I mean, there's general health, there's primary health care, which is what we talk about with the vaccines and blood and all that, that kind of stuff. But there's also the other health benefits of having a refrigerator in your life.
Yeah.
So being able to store meats and fish and fresh produce. So there's those general health benefits, but there's also economic benefits. So a farmer in the middle of India who's cropping taking a crop and bringing it to market, how do they keep it cool? They're at the mercy of the market. So everyone's mangoes are ripening exactly the same time. Suddenly there's a glut on the market. You get nothing for them.
Sure.
If you can keep them for a few weeks and you can sell them into the market when there's not so much product in the market, then you get a much better price. So I've worked on a few scenarios for modelling that, particularly in the agricultural sector. And the interesting thing about that is that you go to a farm and you say, okay, what are you growing? They say, with potatoes. And you go, well, we can't help you much because potatoes aren't worth very much. But the only reason they grow potatoes is because that's easy to grow and it's easy to get to the market. Yep. But if you gave people refrigeration, enabled them to have refrigeration, then they could grow higher value crops. So it multiplies the income that they can generate by the fact that they've got this this refrigeration, and that refrigeration can feed into the what we call the cold chain, which is the linkage of all of those places. So from the field all the way to the supermarket shelf, if you've got a chain of cold devices all the way down there, then you can keep this product perfectly in perfect good condition until it gets to the consumer.
Yeah, and that's something we really take for granted in this country. That a lot of people don't see that from wherever, even if they're being transported from the other side of Europe or the US, there's this continuous chain of refrigeration this entire way.
Well, but what's really interesting about that is actually there's some quite big gaps in that cold chain.
Right.
So there are some really big challenges all the way down the line. So from the farmer's field to the truck that takes it to the airport, to the air transportation that might take it across the to the UK airport, and then from the UK airports to the warehouses, and even in the supermarkets themselves. So there's some really big challenges all the way down there, and we've actually got solutions for all of that chain. There are little bits that we can do, little tweaks that we can do to help all the way down the chain. So to give you a for instance there, one of the issues that are facing supermarkets and retailers generally is the cost of electricity. So we've got these huge high demands for electricity from people like supermarkets, and what they're looking to do is to try and reduce the energy cost of running and bringing down the price of foods and stuff. So one way to do that is to cut the amount of electricity that you use, fine. But the other way that you can do that is to shift when you use electricity. So if you can buy cheap electricity, for instance, in the middle of the night or a particular time of the week, then you can save an awful lot of money. In fact, electricity might not cost you anything if you can actually slot it into a time when there's oversupply of electricity. So the more and more renewables that come onto the system, the more there's a need to soak up this kind of oversupply in the network. And so we can offer, in the short yield technology, we can offer the ability to time shift the energy. We talk about in the vaccine world, we talk about 10, 12 days of holdover time. So that's time without power. And that's at 43 degrees centigrade. So that's in massively high tropical temperatures. So doing a day or two of holdover time, doing 12 hours of holdover time is very easy. Doing a day or two, piece of cake. You know, doing more than that, that's possible. So we can offer this amazing flexibility in when people consume power. So that's down to, you know, it's obvious with the supermarkets and the big retailers because they've got big electricity bills. But a household could also do the same thing. So you imagine all the refrigerators, domestic refrigerators in the UK, could be turned off, could be controlled. You know, okay, your stuff's not going to get warm because the short-yield technology will keep the thing cold for days. But the network would be able to control when they supply the energy to that refrigerator or the thousands of millions of refrigerators around the country, which gives the network a massive amount of flexibility. So some really big ideas behind this thing. So there's some immediate human need in developing countries, but there's also some big commercial ideas in the developed world as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So all these applications, so helping companies manage their expenditure better, helping farmers make more money out of what they grow and be able to grow better things, improving access to medicine and healthcare, that kind of over wider part of the world. So this technology is fantastic, and it started with something very, very simple. Like, really, that technology is simple. So that there are many intermediate steps between having that brilliant idea and implementing it in a way that makes sense. Could you describe maybe the steps after this idea first came to you, and what were the real major challenges that you faced so far?
Yeah, I think some of there's a kind of myth that the ideas come to you in a flash, or you're sitting in the bath and suddenly eureka, you know, there's a flash of inspiration, and you know it's a fully formed idea about how the thing should be manufactured and where it's going to go. And the reality is not quite like that. Yes, there are inspirational moments, and yes, you will sit there and suddenly think, hang on, could I do this like this? And the process of turning that into a product that's marketable has many, many steps and takes a very long time. So for instance, the short chill idea was an idea that I had. I'd seen some things working, and I'd been working in the renewable energy sector, I think, as I've said, and I'd seen thermosiphons working. So a thermosiphon is when you heat up water, the water rises and goes to a storage tank. Maybe you've got a wood burner or something like that, or a stove. It goes to the storage tank, stays in the storage tank, and cold water comes down and circulates around. So you've got this kind of system that circulates around and around. And actually, that's what I originally thought how this thing should work.
Right.
So I set up a system where I created a thermosiphon in a box. So I created a box where I could put things that I wanted to get cold. And so heat would be taken away in this kind of chimney of water up into an ice compartment. And I thought I'd see this circulation of hot and cold water going around this loop that I'd created. And I sat there and I watched this thing working, and it didn't work because because it all became the same temperature. And I was like, well, hang on a minute. I failed, haven't I? This isn't working. That was a waste of time building that old test rig. But then it started to occur to me that actually, no, something different is happening here. There are actually circulation patterns happening, but they're not happening in the way that I thought they would. So that was really interesting. And that it was the development of that. And then you take that to the next level. You start to build prototypes. And then you start talking to people about it and saying, are you interested in this? And they say, well, I've never seen anything like this before. I remember having a conversation with some guys, and they turned around to me after a half-hour presentation and said, look, we've been in this business. We've been making refrigerators for 30, 40 years between us, and we've never seen anything like this before. If this is such a great idea, why has nobody done this before? Yeah. It can't be true. It can't be right. Yeah. It can't be working, right? So there's a lot of that kind of skepticism as well. So you're saying, well, okay, just do it yourself. Fill your glass of water. Measure the temperature at the bottom of it. Show me, tell me that that's not working. And I'll show you a refrigerator where it works. You know, I'll show you a mock-up of how it can work. Yeah. So there's a lot of that. And then you've got to try and attract money. You've got to try and get people to back the idea and back the development of products to get them out into the market. You've got to convince the market that this is something that they can recognize and they can need. So for the vaccine market, for instance, it's the World Health Organization that regulate that market. So I've got to go to the World Health Organization and say, hey, I've got this really wacky idea for keeping vaccines cold, and get them to change their mind, and more to the point, change the standards, because the standards are written around conventional refrigerators. And so it doesn't really match this new technology. So then there's years of kind of working on them and massaging them and getting them to understand, not just as one individual, but as a group of people, that this is a piece of technology that can really work and can really help. And then suddenly, ping, you can see the light bulbs going off, ping, 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 ping. And everybody suddenly gets it, and everybody's suddenly behind it. And everyone's like, oh, this is the best thing since sliced bread. Oh, this is amazing. Somebody tell Bill Gates. He's going to be really interested in this.
Yeah. So it's a common theme, I think, of any of these kinds of really different technologies. getting things wrong a lot of times before you get it right,
yeah.
and having to really push against the status quo of what people accept.
Absolutely, yeah, because people have got it in their minds what it is they want, what it is that works. You know, a fridge is a fridge, right? A fridge is a thing that takes electricity all the time.
Yeah.
What's this thing about not taking electricity all the time? What does that mean? What are the ramifications? How is that going to affect our market? How does that change my job? Where am I still relevant? You know, there's all of that kind of stuff also going on in people's minds.
I think one thing that really helps, I imagine helped you, is the fact that your demonstration or your way of visualising this thing was so simple. Like, we have 2 out of 3 ingredients to make a demonstration on the table right now. We have a glass of water, and we have water.
Yeah.
We don't have the ice, but we could quite easily get some. Yeah. I think being able to put things in those terms helps so much.
Yeah.
Having a technology that maybe itself is complicated, but you can say, oh, imagine this thing happening, and everybody can do that. It's got to help persuading and kind of
Absolutely.
Get the point across.
And you make the point, well, the technology itself is very simple to explain, but you try and build a fluid dynamic model of the circulation of water, the phase change of ice. You've got 2 lots of air going on inside a system. So you've got a compartment inside where there's air moving around. You've got product inside, which is actually the thing that you're looking to refrigerate. So you've got a system which is the product, you've got a system which is the air inside the compartment, you've got the water inside the system, the phase change of the ice, and then you've got another system outside of that. So you've got all of these layers of fluid dynamics going on within, and then, you know, material properties of conduction through different materials. It's really, really complicated thing to do. It's a massively complicated thing to do.
Of course.
But I can sit here and explain it to you in 2 minutes because it's the fundamental principle is there, and everyone knows you can go and look it up. 4 degrees is where water's heaviest, and we exploit that natural property.
Yeah, superb. I think another good part of this story as well, if you don't mind me saying this, like, you've had a pretty long career before you developed this technology. Like, a lot of the stories you hear about, be it, I don't know, the development of Google or Apple or whatever, these guys are straight out of college, maybe even more illustrious college dropouts. They have their idea age 20. I'm now 21, so according to that story, I've missed the boat. I think that it's a good side of the story that really you've had a huge amount of experience and in the field kind of knowledge development that has enabled you to get to where you are today. And I think that's really good to know.
That's true. It's also true that I've had a lot of other ideas.
Yeah.
So the secret, they say, to having one good idea is to have lots of ideas. And out of those lots of ideas, you'll get one good idea or a few good ideas. Now, so all the way through, I mean, that heat storage cooker project that I was talking about, that is amazing. The way that unit works is absolutely amazing. The downside to that story is that it never got commercialized and it never got made. But the principles behind that are absolutely fantastic. They're absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
What we did over that period. So yes, it's great to have one good idea. It's great to be recognised for one good idea. But actually, it's made up of hundreds of other ideas that have gone before.
Yeah.
As well. So you kind of keep pushing. You keep doing new stuff. You keep pushing new things. And maybe there's more to come. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I didn't just sort of suddenly walk around in the hills and have one idea and that's been my life.
Yeah.
You know, I've been pushing boundaries. You know, I entered the renewable energy business basically in the 1970s, early 80s is when I started playing around with it. I entered it professionally in the mid 80s when there was no commercial renewables industry in the UK. There was one company making wind turbines. There was one company playing around with solar panels, but they weren't commercially successful. They weren't, you know, this was view to the future. So it takes a lot of vision. It takes a lot of kind of, I don't want to say guts so much, just commitment, you know. I wasn't really interested in doing anything else. I didn't really want to build rockets and cars and, you know, that kind of stuff. They're interesting things. And I did have a very short career making machine tools. I was a machine tool designer. I made automated machines, and they worked very, very well. And I was very pleased with them. And as sort of automata, I thought they were very elegant.
Yeah.
And I could sit and watch them for hours, you know, like a sewing machine, sort of tick, 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 going and making all these bits and pieces. But at the end of the day, they didn't really do anything for me. It didn't really get me excited. I could see all of these other issues around me, all these other people that potentially could do with a bit of help. And here am I making this little thing that just kind of goes chug in the middle of a factory. And I just thought, nah, I don't want to do that. I want to do something much, much more interesting, much broader kind of benefit.
Yeah. So you think your motivation was like, I want to work on something that's gonna have a big impact. I see a gap in the market and I see this having a wide impact.
It wasn't about, oh, I can make a big success about this. I'm gonna make loads of money. I'm gonna be famous. This was about, I really believe in this. I really believe that this is the right thing to do. I want to do this. I want to do this for my children and my grandchildren, and I want to be, you know, that's what I want to spend my time doing. I could carry on making machine tools. I could carry on, you know, bolstering the profit of people that run factories to make widgets. But there's lots of other people that do that.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm interested in doing other things, and I'm prepared to put myself out a bit. You know, I'm prepared to travel all around the world and, you know, have new experiences and enjoy other cultures. And that's been that's also been another super benefit of the career path that I took, is sort of traveling around and having the privilege of being involved in people's lives in parts of the world that most people don't get to access, but they don't even get to see a lot of this stuff. You know, taking yourself to a little village in the middle of Nigeria and sitting down with the people in the village and having dinner and working with the guys there to put a system together and understanding the issues that they've got, bringing that back and re-engineering systems so that it works better next time, and being able to pass that on to other people who are also trying to build systems for those people. That's great. It's really very rewarding.
Yeah, of course. I think that's a really good message, actually. Like, for people who don't necessarily know what they want to do with their careers, but I think there's a lot of people who are teenagers now who are really quite driven to make a really great impact. They see problems in the world all over the place. It's hard not to at the moment. And I would personally say, and I'm sure you'd agree, that engineering and producing technology is a fantastic way to do that. It's almost the number one way to make a positive benefit to people's lives.
Absolutely, yeah. No, and you can really get out there and you can make just, you know, brick by brick by brick, you know, build this massive wall of kind of technology to help people to improve their lives.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't forget, you know, most of my inspiration comes from people that I've met and things that I've seen, things that I've done in developing countries. It's not like I'm the clever guy sitting over here in the UK and I'm taking my clever ideas to you people who live in Africa. It's a collaboration. It really is a collaboration between those people and their ideas and what they've got to say, how, you know, that their inputs to it. My skill, I guess, is kind of pulling that together. So being able to pick the better ideas from the table in the developed world, and pull the more relevant kind of information from the inputs that I can get from the field, and pulling those together and making that into something which is really useful.
Yeah. So in terms of your skills, like, I don't know if you've mentioned what your original kind of training was post school, and what skills you kind of need now, and how that's developed over the years.
Okay. So I started off. So I was the product of a grammar school. And so there was a big push at the grammar school to do academic subjects and to get accepted into high-level universities.
Yeah.
And I wasn't bad. I wasn't bad at maths. I wasn't bad at English. I wasn't bad at any of those things. But I wasn't really that interested in a lot of them. I was actually very interested in working with my hands. I was interested in metalwork and woodwork and all of these kind of things. And actually, at my school, it wasn't really considered a real topic. So I took subjects at A level. I was forced to take physics at A level, which I didn't want to do. I wanted to take more practical subjects. But when I came out of school, I took myself off to do an engineering design degree. Now, in 1978, as it was there were, I think, maybe two courses in the UK that did engineering design. Mm-hmm. You either did engineering or you did design. And artists did design and engineers did engineering, right? There were no,
yeah.
So this was an attempt to bring those two together. And so I was actually in the second year of that course. So I studied as an engineering product designer. Mm-hmm. So it was all about designing products. It was about looking very broadly across that sort of product design skill set, from that sort of very hard engineering side to a very soft kind of arty, crafty side as well. And so that was really good grounding for me. And out of that, then I went to work on making machine tools, and I thought that was quite an interesting thing to do because there's lots of mechanical stuff going on. And then I started to get a bit bored with that and thought, you know, I could do something more interesting. And took myself off to do a master's and got sponsorship from a renewable energy company, from a solar company, one of the only solar company in the UK at the time, to make a solar water pumping system. And so that was my kind of, that was kind of my lever to get in through the door into renewable energy, because now I had experience and you know, I was one of the few people in the UK and actually for many years, one of the few people in the world that had expertise in solar powered water pumping systems. Mm. So I was quite valuable to a lot of the charities and aid organisations that were trying to do projects like that. So I did my master's in solar-powered pumping. Then I joined the Centre for Alternative Technology in Mid Wales, where they were doing some really wild and wacky stuff about renewable energy, how you use it and what you do with it. And we started a little company there to look at providing the learning that we had from the Centre for Alternative Technology, providing that to the outside world, providing products to the outside world and applying the technologies. And that was what I was really interested in doing, was kind of getting the technologies out there and getting engaged with people, getting engaged with the market, enabling people to kind of come and access this technology in a very real sense. So it's not just some academic exercise. Yes, yeah. You can buy solar panels and you can buy a battery. It's like, yeah, but how do you practically link those two things together? What kind of cables do you use? And all the boring stuff about how do you package that up to make it last the journey to get it to the little village where it's going to be applied. It's all very well kind of just having it, but you know, how do you actually get it to do some good for people and to do it in a way which is meaningful? You know, not just, you know, you're taking a bunch of kit and then planting it in a village. That's not necessarily sustainable. So there's all sorts of human stuff around that as well, about ownership of the system. I had one story. I was doing a project in Africa, and we went to, so this is a project that's funded by the local government, so there was a state government of the country we were in, and we went to the village and we said, see that hand pump there, so we want to replace that with a solar pump, because we can see there was a queue of people, I've got photographs of it, but there's a queue of people standing there for hours waiting to use this hand pump, and they'd stand there pump, filling buckets and containers. And it took ages, and it was a real pain for them. So we said, fine, okay, well, the governor has said he's going to fund this solar-powered water pump. Take us a couple of days, we'll fiddle around, and we'll have a solar water pump. No, they said. So what's the problem? They said, well, we're not going to let you do that because you're making lots of money out of it, and we're not making any money out of it. You're going to have to help us somehow. And so I was escorted off the site, and negotiations went on, and eventually I was allowed back on and we carried on and did our work. But there was a kind of expectation on our side that because we were doing good, that everybody would appreciate that and it would all be very lovely. Right. But actually these people were saying, no, you know, you've got to do more than this for us. Okay, yeah, we appreciate the fact that you're going to put a solar water pumping system in, but actually we need cash as well. Mm. Help us to do that. So what I'm saying is that it's not always just as straightforward as saying, I've got a piece of technology, everyone's going to accept it, it's going to be good, and right down the line, everyone's just going to be, oh, clap, 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 oh, wonderful, oh, bring it in, because life isn't like that, the world isn't like that.
Yeah.
And so you've got to be cleverer than that to actually make a success of getting products properly in the field and properly sustainable.
Yeah. Half the problems are the social problems or the economic problems, exactly. Not just solving the technology.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
So your career's kind of, it has certainly been varied. Would you say that you ever had anything resembling a plan? And do you have a plan now for the future? it's interesting to see when I ask people this question, the variety of responses.
Yeah. I don't think I ever really did have a plan. I think that the fact is that I have always followed my heart. And when it's felt right to do something, I've done that thing. I think that probably means I'm not as financially secure at this moment in my life as I ought to be. Is there a plan? Unfortunately, no, still not quite, really. I'd like to see this technology, this amazing bit of technology, I'd like to see it through So that it is actually benefiting more people.
Yep.
So I'd like to see products out there that aren't just vaccine fridges. I mean, vaccine fridges are absolutely amazing, and they are making a difference to millions of people's lives right now. Mm. But there's more we can do with the technology. So I would like to see that through into domestic refrigerators. I'd like to see refrigerators for helping farmers for agricultural purposes. And the other applications, the commercial applications, yeah, they're good and they'll help and they're useful. To me personally, as a human being, yeah, they're good and the benefit for me, it would be measured in how much more renewable energy we can integrate into the system, rather than just how much extra money someone yeah. can make out of that. So no particular plan. I think I think a lot of it has been guided by what I've wanted to do and when I wanted to do it, which sounds really privileged, and I have been very privileged in that sense. But then there's times when it's a long, hard slog. There's years and years when there's no money. You know, I came into the industry when there was no real commercial use for these technologies, so that meant years and years with very, very little money. Just doing it because I really believed it was the right thing to do, and then all of a sudden, there's commercial reality and money starts to come. So I think, yeah, my advice would always be to people, follow what you really want to do. You won't get bored, you won't get unhappy by doing what you really want to do. You will do, if you just do something just for money or for some other reason, then at some point you're just going to feel that it's a waste of time. Because you'll just be paying the bills, you'll just be buying yourself a new car. It's like there's no end to that.
Yeah.
But the satisfaction from doing something that you really feel is important or gives you a kick, just makes you laugh. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. But following those kind of things will give you pleasure and will give you inner happiness, if you like.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I actually think that's a fantastic note to end this on. I think that's a superb message. So, Ian, thank you very much for coming and speak to me. It's been really great. Yeah, thank you very much. Cheers.
Yeah,
and good luck
with
the company.
Great
stuff.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this week's episode of Ingenious, please subscribe and share the podcast with friends. We'd also love to hear your feedback. To get in touch or to find out more about us and our guests, head to ingeniouspod.org. Music for our episodes is kindly provided by Yemzo Katana. Check him out on SoundCloud.
Online.
Not on FM.
And certainly not on digital.
This is Burst Radio.
Bristol University's radio station. Radio station. Radio station. Radio station.